So the talk tonight is about why are you unhappy? And before I get into it, how about that dinner tonight? Get enough root vegetables there? Starting to feel a little like Thanksgiving. Starting to feel a little like a potluck. Starting to feel a little like I'm not sure which of these to take. Hope you liked it. I told you our cook was energetic. I think we might be seeing some leftovers. Between the years 1958 and 1974, some books appeared in this world, which is the only world we know. Every other world is imaginative. And these books were written by a mysterious, largely unavailable to physical proximity being named Wee Woo Wee. And what he did in these books was he synthesized some things in a very profound way. He synthesized the teachings of the Buddha with Taoism and the teachings of Ramana Maharshi and other sources. He pulled very skillfully together and gave very direct teachings in these books. And he also asked this question, why are you unhappy? And then he gave an answer. See how this sounds to you. His answer is, because 99.9% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself. And there isn't one. I don't know about you folks, but for me, when I was being trained in this stuff here, my favorite part of the day was the Dharma talk, because that was a time to not meditate. If you notice, the mind, and the emotions, and the perception can have a sort of dual relationship with this stuff. In certain moments, there's something about this that as intense as it is, it's something about it that's so right, it's so good. You kind of fall in love. And then there's another part that just hates it. And it can move back and forth like that. I love it, I hate it. And that's the way it is with anybody you get close enough to also, isn't it? You kind of love them on Tuesday and hate them on Thursday. And you can't always predict which way it's going to go and how deep, you know, it's going to go in either direction. So we spend a lot of time, it seems, taking care of the body, taking care of the body needs, feeding the body, bathing the body, adjusting the body, clothing the body, warming it up, cooling it off, sleeping it, waking it up, and on it goes. And then there's the mind, you know, taking care of this mind. Harder to do in a way. I mean, some of us, really, sometimes it's a struggle to take care of the body. Don't have enough time. Lazy. I don't really need to. It'll take care of itself. I'll do it later, you know. There's an amazing thing, I think, came off of the television, actually, where they were talking about how these home exercise machinery that you buy and put in your house, that hardly anybody ever uses that once they get it in the house. It just like sits there, collects dust, and then it goes on eBay or Craigslist, you know, or the neighbor gets it. You know, I have a brother who's constantly trying to give me these extremely archaic and dysfunctional Nordic track machines. You know, those things where you're like cross-country skiing in your garage and it's just not quite the same as being in the snow if you've ever done it. You know, you just, okay, you just get into it, move your arms a little more, and pretty soon it just kind of collects dust And then after a while, you don't even have to use it, but the cable underneath just breaks because it just kind of falls apart because it's been sitting so long. I'm going to get back to my dear birth brother, but probably not tonight. He sent me a text before the talk, and he said, "Meditate on the Buddha for me." He's a bit of a loose cannon. We'll get back to that. This is all in perception. I mean, he wouldn't agree. You know, he's not a loose cannon. It's just that some of those around him think he is. It's not a bad idea. So how do you meditate on the Buddha? And then for him. So why are you unhappy? Well, the whole thrust and the function of the meditation in particular and the spiritual teachings in our world in general are to assist in the awakening and a clarification of your true identity or your true nature, or you could say your Buddha nature, your original nature, your essential nature. And that's our essential nature. And this nature is, it's not a state of mind. It's not a feeling. It's not a perception. It's not a thought. And so it's not an experience in the common way that we speak about experiences. And this is, in a way, the simplest and therefore, in a way, the most difficult thing for the mind. Because this that is being pointed at is extremely subtle. And that it's, and the fact is that it's not an object of experience. It cannot be objectified, which means it can't be known in the way that we typically know things. So this is a conundrum for us when it comes to really understanding ourselves experientially, knowing what we are. And if we know what we are, then the confusion, doubt, and fear goes away. So it can't be understood in the way that we typically understand things or objects. It can only be realized and or awakened to, or you could say seen clearly. And that is interesting because this seeing clearly that I'm pointing at, really the best way to say that is it's an ever-deepening of the realization of that which sees. See? So it's not something that you see. It's what sees. It's an ever-deepening realization of that which sees. Its nature is formless, which means it's not in a fixed locale. It's everywhere. And of course, now, very important, it's in everything. You see, so it's in every object, everything. Just like the space in this room is inseparable from the objects in this room. Right? And the only thing that would say the space and the objects, let's say these bodies, are separate would be a thought. Oh, there's space, and then there's this. And then there's a distance there, isn't there? But in if you go to the feeling sense of the room and the objects in the room, that line softens or it goes away. And there's a sense of non-separation. Let me draw from a couple of very important additional characters. There's some very interesting characters to draw from in this business here. And this is Han San. Zen master, lived in the year 1600, basically about 1620 to about 620 to about 660 or so. Didn't live very long, about 40 years. He said it like this. His words are very good. "My home was at Cold Mountain from the start, rambling among the hills, far from trouble. Gone. And a million things leave no trace. Loosened, and it flows through the galaxies. A fountain of light into the very mind. Not a thing, and yet it appears before me. Now I know the pearl of the Buddha nature, know its use, a boundless, perfect sphere. On sun. Slightly different angle. I like this character even better, because reportedly he was 7 feet tall and he had a pearl-shaped lump in the middle of his forehead. I like that. Especially the 7 feet tall part with the lump. Hung Po is his name. Lived in the 1800 to about early 800 to about 900. Right in there. A couple hundred years after Hun Sun. Listen to how he puts it. Ordinary beings are the Buddha, just as they are. The Buddha is one with them. Both have the same nature. The phenomenal universe and nirvana, that means extinction of suffering, by the way, activity and stillness all have the same nature. So do all possible worlds and the state that transcends all worlds. The beings that pass through the 6 stages of existence, those who have undergone the 4 kinds of birth, all the worlds with their vast mountains and rivers, enlightenment and delusion, all of them are the same. When I say that they all have the same nature, I mean that their names and forms, their existence and non-existence are empty. The vast world systems, uncountable as the sands of the Ganges, and all contained in the one boundless, empty, radiant mind. How then can there be Buddhas who save or ordinary beings who must be saved? If the true nature of all things is the same, how can such distinctions be real? You like that? Is that clear? Wow, 7 feet tall with a lump on the third eye. That'll get you clear. In a way, the biggest apparent, very important to put that word there, apparent impediment to seeing true nature, which means to live as it, you see, to live as it, is that we get identified and very involved with various kinds of unhappiness and dissatisfactions. And then we spend a fair amount of time and effort, sometimes engaging in all kinds of ways of trying to be happy, including meditation and other forms of spiritual practice, recreation activities, and so forth. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing right about it either. It's just something that we do. Unhappiness drives the whole desire system in the minds of humans. And even as we get what we want in various ways, which we do at times, we only rest for a short while before there's some degree or other of unhappiness settling up, coming up again. And we seek and start working and looking for its release. Which means we start up again, inwardly or outwardly, looking for happiness. So you could say we get bound up in trying to not be unhappy, and trying to keep happiness around when we get it. We might try to hold on to the happy, look for ways to avoid being unhappy again. We try to figure this out, how to live this way, And it's very, very popular. It has many different shapes and forms and stylizations. Relatively speaking, okay, no doubt, when unhappiness is released, there's a kind of relief. There's even a relief that comes when something that's pleasant releases. When anything releases, there's a kind of relief. If there's a pressure, a tension, a pain, some kind of unhappiness, wanting in the mind, and it releases more or less some relative happiness, then can emerge. Very key word there, relative happiness. So the third noble truth of the Buddha, the cessation, it wasn't just the cessation of suffering, it's the cessation, the dissipation, the dissolution of anything. And of course, that cessation, that dissipation, that transformation of anything leads to other things. Einstein, again, very clear, energy can't be created nor destroyed, it simply changes in form. Okay, that's the Dharma right there. He might not have used that word, but that's what he was expressing. If the mind gets confused, it gets deluded into trying to hold on to desirable experiences, that generates suffering right there. But also the other side of the coin, when the mind is trying to create pleasant, happy, satisfying experiences, and of course it always only can succeed to some extent. Sometimes it can't succeed at all. It really just totally fails. Even if it has a good plan on how to do it, it just doesn't turn out the way you like. Trying to avoid being unhappy, trying to avoid being happy, round and round and round it can go. Where it stops, nobody knows. So the meditation in particular and the spiritual teachings in general, they're here. And they're here to fundamentally assist in this cycle, to assist in understanding it, what drives it. Why are we unhappy? A couple of answers. We want something we don't have. It's essentially greed. Just to call it out, want something we don't have, it's essentially greed. Don't want something you do have, it's essentially aversion. Not clear about what to want and what to not want, that's delusion. Not clear about what's worth wanting, not clear about what's worth not wanting, it's just all jumbled. I'll just go back to some good old healthy greed, some good old healthy aversion, because I can't, this delusion thing is just too much for me. I was fine in my wanting, I was fine in my resistance, now I'm just a mess. It's worse than that windshield wiper exercise some of us did. How about wanting people to be different? Wanting situations to be different? Generating imaginations about how those situations could be different. Investing hopes in those situations being different. Being disappointed when they don't turn out different. Being disappointed when you don't turn out different. Making plans, fantasies for the future. And then feeling let down when the weather doesn't turn out the way I like. Feeling inadequate, unworthy, unlovable, uncertain, insecure, frightened. By what? Being alive. Four reservoirs of repressed emotion that humans can have: anger, hurt, unfulfilled needs, and fear. we don't find a way to deal with these things, whatever your particular sort of quota or stylization of these things are, if we don't have a way to deal with this directly and clearly, it can make you unhappy. Carrying the past around in the mind. How about that one? Carrying the past around in the mind, like a backpack in your head, all kinds of reasons that you carry it around because you feel you've been wronged, you've been mistreated, you've been neglected, you've been ignored. People weren't nice. Feeling victimized and then blaming and holding others accountable for my unhappiness. I'm not saying that people don't do bad things to others, bad things to you. You fall in harm's way. Don't see it coming. You would have taken a left on Elm Street if you could have, but you didn't. You went straight down Oak. And you got slapped. Piling on the unhappiness. We don't just have these forms of potential unhappiness. Pile on some more unhappiness by building up a story about how these things happened. And that story in the mind about how things happened is always bias. It's always bias. But when the anger or the hurt, or whatever those feelings are, get righteous enough, they say, this is the way it happened. And meanwhile, we're the ones who are hurting from that. We're the ones being unhappy with that. It's bad enough, isn't it, in a way, when things don't go well? But then the mind jumps on the case and builds up even more unhappiness through the story it tells. And it can go over and over and over with that story, and it can pull others in and tell the story. It gets a little bit of ventilation because it vents it out, you know, if you get somebody to listen, and they'll listen enough. You vent it out. But if you look closely, what has really been discovered other than a venting? What has really happened there? Are you relieved? Or did you just vent some of that frustration and you're still unchanged? You might discover, you might have an insight in there. You know what? There wasn't much of any real significance in that action of venting. It might have been better, you might have thought, to just keep my mouth shut. I like it when people say, stop me if I go on too long. Did I say that before? Don't let me get carried away. A million ways we can try to have others take care of us, subtle or not so subtle. Because we're feeling vulnerable, we're feeling shook, we're feeling unhappy. How about blaming the big one in the sky? For some of us, whether we like it or not, it's a guy. This guy up there. I didn't ask for that. I didn't ask for a guy to be planted in my big sky. Why did I get a guy with a beard? Sometimes other things like swords and pokers. It wasn't on my menu. I didn't even know that I had a menu. So the big one in the sky. Blame the big one in the sky for the unfortunate happenings in our lives, feeling forsaken, abandoned, rejected, forgotten, and holding a grudge about it because we haven't admitted, we haven't really faced the fact that we're utterly vulnerable. We're utterly tender. We're as tender as a newborn baby that comes out, that absolute tenderness, the bones not yet ossified, the skin just changing color right before those that are watching his eyes, just seeing that change. I remember my son being born. It looked like the shape of his head changed right in front of my eyes. Of course, I hadn't slept for a few days, so that'll do it too. But just, whoa, and that tenderness, that absolute tenderness, the way you might touch a newborn baby's head if you touched it, that's how tender we are. And we don't want to admit this. Because vulnerability and tenderness sometimes gets a bad rap, like you got to be strong, you got to keep it together, don't be weak, know what you're doing. More than that, know who you are. It's wonderful to hear from somebody who says, know who you are. That person has no idea who they are, and they're telling you to know who you are. Know what you want, state how you feel. I mean, sometimes they know a little bit, but a lot of times anybody who's talking like that really is out of sorts. So this vulnerable, tender, open nature of what we are, and the fact that life is literally living itself through us. Life is living itself through us. I mean, dinner is living itself through us. The enthusiasm of the root vegetables is living itself through us. The air, the sun, the earth, each other living through us. And here's a really important turning now. And there's something about us, there's something about us that is never harmed no matter what happens. Never harmed, no matter what happens. After multiple rounds on the Ferris wheel, I'd asked my wife about this part of the talk. I said, what's the difference between the merry-go-round and the Ferris wheel? And this is what she came up with. I don't know whether it's right. Maybe you do. She said, the merry-go-round is going like this, but the Ferris wheel is going like this. And I said, okay, I want the Ferris wheel in the talk. After multiple rounds on the Ferris wheel of relative happiness and relative unhappiness, it's relative, isn't it? Relative happiness, relative unhappiness. We might get interested in not only what drives the whole system, but how to get off the Ferris wheel. If you don't get interested in what drives certain things that are unsatisfactory, how can you expect to get off? Because even if you go to somebody who you think understands, and you put yourself in enough, if you can muster it, surrender or trust, to really receive what they have to say or what they have to offer, if that's what you're drawn to, and they say something or they do something, it's still going to be up to you to receive, to understand, to in some way comprehend what it is that they give, isn't it? Is it possible to stop going up and down over and over, stop being happy and unhappy over and over? Is it possible to get off the Ferris wheel? It's interesting. I was talking to this, he was a scientist, and he was getting his PhD in something, I forget what it was. It was some kind of combination of psychology and science. And our connection was kind of coming and going over about a 6-month period. We'd see each other briefly for reasons, and then we, you know, a little conversation, then we'd part. And so I was kind of tracking him, watching, you know, what was unfolding there. And he began to talk like, I don't know whether what I'm doing is worth it. He began to have doubt, he began to have uncertainty, he began to see
maybe all this work is not worth it. Maybe I'm not even going to be able to do what I want to do with this stuff. And he had some idea what he wanted to do. Then he made a comment that just was like out of left field, right field, center field, somewhere. It was out of the ballpark, really. That's a better image. It just came in from a different ballpark. He said, I think it's going to be a great relief to die. And he said it kind of like in a way that wasn't like morbid. It was kind of like interested and curious, but it had a tinge, just a tinge of escapism in it. That's the way some people do it. Oh, I know when I'll get off the Ferris wheel. When I'm dead. And they manifest one of the specific forms of clinging. See, the Buddha was very clear about everything he said. As far as I can tell. And he said there's three kinds of clinging. There's clinging to the sensory pleasure, which is a temporary relative kind of happiness. There's clinging to existence as you perceive it. And that's, of course, an I that wants to continue to exist and not die. Or things that I is connected to. People, places, things don't want to leave you. And then he said there's a third kind of clinging, and that's the clinging to non-existence. We don't have this stuff sorted out. As a culture, we don't have it at all. So if you want to get a little bit more freedom about how you might be able to die, you got to move to Oregon. And even then, it could be rough because you might not be connected to... I mean, in that most tender sense, like, we don't remember what it was like to have the body be born, but it happened. We came down the chute. We came out C-section, however it happened. Come over, some of us came out ass first, believe that or not. There's at least somebody in here who must have. I don't know the percentages on that one. First movement out of that space, out of that water, out of that place where you don't breathe through here, you don't eat through here, it's all coming straight through here, and you come out butt first. Now that's a meditation. I came out drugged. My mother was completely anesthetized. The doctors took over and they took me out with the clamps. 1956. That means the drug part particularly, anything goes wrong in the talk, I got an excuse. And I don't even know what the drugs were. But if she is drugged, I'm drugged, because it's through her blood into me. That tenderness, that vulnerability, that openness, and then when it's time for this to die, oh, that same tenderness, that same vulnerability, that same profound sense of transformation. It's all transformation. There seems to be something about that. And we might go into this tomorrow night or the next night. Really important. Really important. How that death happens. Some who understand these things far, far more than myself, they're in meditation pose and they die meditating, sitting up. And the body just goes... fully aware. Many, many examples of this. Anyways, we got to deal with the Ferris wheel, okay? We can see at times that we perceive or we feel ourselves to be unhappy, and we can see that this unhappiness, this dissatisfaction, this unsatisfactoriness drives the needs for happiness. It drives the perceptions of happiness. It drives the activities connected with hope for happiness. If there was no unhappiness, there would be no search for happiness, wouldn't there? But it's even more profound. Watch this. the very fact that we seek happiness subtly makes us unhappy. And yet, what are we to do? Once we recognize that we're indeed unhappy, we're indeed, to some extent, not satisfied, we then often helplessly, and I do mean that word very intentionally, helplessly find ourselves seeking happiness, employing the best means that we know how. A huge epiphany. That's a big insight. A huge epiphany comes when we realize our efforts to be truly happy through all the various means and efforts have utterly failed. This is the part of the talk, if you're me, where you might wish you were meditating again instead of listening to the talk. What? What? Particular client in psychotherapy, that whenever I use the word try, she says, what? She will not let me try. She says, you can't say that. She's one of those people who kicks you in the shin when you do the wrong thing. She's like a Zen shin kicker. Yes, a huge epiphany comes when we realize our efforts to be truly happy, keyword, truly happy, through all the various means and efforts that we've employed, have utterly failed. Depression, despondency, turn to something not good, like start picking up the bottle or something. People do it. Wow. It didn't work. Wow, this doesn't work. Wow, I'm not working. The ABC liquor store is right around the corner. You don't need to feel this. You don't need to think those thoughts. You just need a little bit of money and just a walk. Or you get in your car in some cases. By the way, the Great Recession apparently didn't touch the ABC market for liquor. Did just fine. We may recognize that we're happiest when we're completely unpreoccupied. And by the way, it happened in the dinner for some of us. You might not have noticed it, but I was watching you. I didn't say that was part of the teaching, that I get to watch you when you're eating. See, you could watch me too. It's up to you. But I watch you sometimes, and here's how some of you eat. And so before it even goes in, I mean, I'm not sure you're mindful of this, but before it even goes in, it's like... And then there's the moments in between. The head's a little this way, the head's a little that way, the eyes are this way, they're down, they're closed. Sneaking in through those moments is the unpreoccupied, open, subtle, carefree presence. Snuck right in there, didn't see it. Just kind of slipped by in between the beet bites. Again, I can't overemphasize, this is very subtle stuff that we're involved in here. Very subtle. And because it's subtle, we overlook it. We overlook what's subtle. We overlook what's obvious. Best therapist I ever had in my life was a man named Robert Hall. He was a psychiatrist, in fact, who had never used a single medication with any of his patients in all of his career.
had a bodywork table in his office. It was a piece of art. It was about that wide. So if your body opened up, the table had you. It wasn't one of these thin jobs where your arms are falling off the side. Next thing you know, your elbows are hurting because they're hanging off. The table was super wide. Stainless steel shaft going down in a hardwood floor. It was a piece of art. This is in California, so he's got a desk. It's made of a slice of a redwood tree. Beautiful. Talk about feng shui. That was just how it looked in the room. His presence. There was no technique. It was just presence. He was just there. One time towards the end of the work with him, I said, person who taught you how to do therapy, what was the essence of their teachings? See, I love to ask a good question when I can. I like to get somebody to really look deep. And I thought, okay, I've been with you for 15 months. I'm going to pop this question. What's the essence of the teachings of the person who taught you how to do therapy? Watch this. He said, and his teacher was Fritz Perls, he said, he taught me to pay attention to the obvious. When we're carefree, when we don't have a care or a concern in the world, we're happy. But even this state of being, this carefree state, of course, like all states, it comes and goes. Can't sustain it. Even if you notice it, you notice it pretty closely, you notice this carefree, unpreoccupied. That's a place that people go into at times, but it's sublime and hidden when they go to the movies. If the movie's good, they totally forget their story. They forget the issues. No wonder it's a popular industry. You can forget yourself. But you see, the other thing is you're getting all this stimulation, and so you got a whole other story. It's called the movie. It's not your movie. It's somebody else's movie, okay, on somebody else's screen. But behind that, you forget your problems. You forget your issues. You become, to some extent, carefree, subconsciously. And you say, oh, it's a great movie. Wonderful movie. You got to see this movie. Hardly anybody says, you got to go into the Buddha nature that's right there behind your interest in the movie. So go to this movie and realize your Buddha nature because it's there behind the movie. Nobody says that. Oh, okay. Maybe I was the first. So this realization, and it's a profound realization, that your efforts to sustain and be happy and avoid unhappiness have utterly failed. Your methods have utterly failed. They utterly, utterly failed. This is devastating. It is devastating. To what? This insight is devastating to the controlling, efforting mind. It nails it. Actually, better word, a little softer. Checkmate. This realization checkmates the controlling, efforting mind. It brings it right to the cliff, right to the edge. And if there isn't a reaction and a pulling back from that, there's some, you might say, grace of humility that comes through. You are stopped in your tracks. The insight stops you in your tracks. Boom. It hasn't worked. And for some people, they just go straight away into confusion. They go straight away into fear. They find another plan off the shelf, out the backpack. They just generate another method. They go out to somebody else right away. But there's some people who just stop. They just stop. And in that stopping, is the possibility of a turning into a whole new direction. Because within that insight that it hasn't worked is the possibility of seeing clearly that you've been going in the wrong direction. I don't know how many of you know this, but the original meaning of the word repent, which has gotten twisted all over the place, particularly in the Christian tradition, in some parts of it at least, things like, okay, you're a sinner, confess your sins, and vow to never sin again. Of course, what was missed there was that the sin word comes from the field of archery, which means when the archer goes like this, and they miss a little or a lot, it was called a sin. That's a little bit different than you're a guilty, terrible, hell-bound person as a sinner. But worse than that, actually, that's pretty bad. Here's how you can come out of being a sinner. Listen to me. I know how to help you. Repent, young man, young woman, repent. Recognize you're off track. Confess it. And commit to not doing it again. That is not the meaning of the word repentance. The meaning of the word repentance is so interesting, the original meaning. It means simply turn and look afresh. It's not our fault that we've been looking in the wrong direction. Seeking happiness is simply something that we've been conditioned to do by others who were seeking happiness. Others before us did it, and they passed it on to us. It's deep in the cells and the neurobiology of this body-mind process. And it's very clear. You go out and you just, I did this recently with an earthworm. I just was touched an earthworm and it just started flipping out. You know, I just, you know that touch, just a little touch and it flipped out and the mind went, whoa, you used to put these things on hooks and you used to fish with them. And that's gone, thank goodness. I used to just do that blindly. It's like one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, he's in the Peace Corps in Thailand and he's not meditating yet and he was in the Peace Corps and they decided as part of the protocol that everybody had to go out into the field and kill chickens. I don't know why, maybe there was too many chickens for that time or we're going to eat the chickens or something. So they're lining up, these Peace Corps volunteers, killing chickens. So he's got this picture that some of his friends took at the time where he had the chicken in his hand, got the head like this and he's ready to lop it off. Blindly. Okay? So years go by, he gets the meditation teaching, he's meditating, and he's dealing with the grief and the anguish of this experience that he did so, like, why didn't I say no? I didn't have to do that. I mean, what was that about? It's that thing where we're so suggestible, it's people get in line and they just start doing it. There's many examples of this. So anyways, he's dealing with this full force, and all the feelings are coming up, and he goes into the dinner table or the breakfast table, and there's the hard-boiled eggs, and he gets the hard-boiled egg, and he cracks it open. There's an embryo chick inside. Whoa. Now that was a full circle. Holy smokes, who's running this show? Blew his mind. Oh, forgiveness. Didn't mention that yet, huh? We screw up royally. And there's that possibility of forgiveness. And if you can't forgive yourself, you can find somebody else who can hold that space for you until you can hold it for yourself. This seeking of happiness is so deep in the neurobiology. It's so deep in
and seemingly as part of this body-mind process. But there's something else here as well that's even deeper and more sublime than this seeking and this Ferris wheel of samsara. Samsara means perpetual wandering. Wandering through the seeking of happiness, losing it, feeling unhappy, seeking it again, seeking it again, seeking it again. All beings don't want to suffer. All beings want happiness. But how we go about it, that's the critical question. Waking up, which is where real happiness is born, waking up from the dream of the Ferris wheel, living on the Ferris wheel. Waking up is not really like opening your eyes when they've been closed. It's more like your eyes are open, and yet they do not actually see what's in front of them. The reason why the eyes don't really see what's in front of them is because we don't recognize what's seen through the eyes. When we recognize, when we begin to recognize, when we begin to wake up to what's seen through the eyes, then automatically the eyes begin to clearly see what's before them. So, another angle on this. I think I can get some brownie points from St. Francis now, who is the saint of all creation. I thought of him with the dinner. His pictures are around here, or at least drawings of him. Some of us really were confused early on in our life by the teachings of Jesus. But what's interesting to me about Jesus, his life and his teachings, was that it appears he taught straight from the heart, and that he taught through parable, he taught through story. He was like a Zen master of that time. And he said something like, heaven is right here on the earth, but humans can't see it. And he carried on to say, in a way, because they're looking for it someplace else. So in a way, this is very connected to what I just said, which is, we don't recognize what's seen through our eyes, and therefore we don't see clearly what's before us. We don't see heaven. As we begin to recognize what it is that's seen through our eyes, hearing through our ears, feeling through our body, recognizing that which sees, what is behind the eyes and the senses. You could almost say it like this, noticing the place that thoughts come from. We discover something quite extraordinary and at the same time absolutely ordinary. We discover that awareness is never dissatisfied. Awareness is never unhappy. Awareness never seeks happiness. Awareness never seeks anything. It never tries to avoid, negate, or deny anything. And it's effortlessly present, but not until it's recognized.
until it's recognized, or prior to it being recognized, it's obscured. It's swirled in the shuffle. The difficult thing about the Buddha nature, which awareness is the conduit to, is that you can't actually describe it, even though these characters took a shot and the words had a resonance for me, maybe for you. You can't say what it is, you can kind of just say what it's like. Same thing with awareness. You can't really say what awareness is, but you can kind of say what it's like. So awareness is like the ocean. And the waves are like experiences that come and go in the ocean. And the waves are never disconnected from the ocean, are they? Nor can they ever quite express the ocean's depth, can they? Or another image. Awareness is like the vast blue sky. And experiences are like the clouds in the sky. And in the unpreoccupied, yeah, carefree, just gazing into the sky, who would bother to say the clouds are separate from the sky? Who would bother with that thought? What would be the point of drawing those things apart? Some of you may know the life and teachings of Milarepa. Milarepa is one of the greatest Tibetan yogis, meditation masters of his time. And in his younger life, Milarepa really, really was out of control and did some terrible things. He killed human beings. It's a little bit complicated how it all happened. There was difficulties in the village and with the family, and there was abuse, and there was different things going on, and his mother, so forth, and family, you know, things were happening there. And I think it was actually, if I'm not mistaken, his mother told him to just go ahead and just kill that person, and he went and did it. So he was really, 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 like, messed up. Like, really messed up. And he also was a deep spiritual aspirant simultaneously, and his teaching Marpa, or teacher Marpa, gave him the teachings, and he progressed amazingly fast and became a great, great saint. And his life is an amazing life if you ever want to look at it. Milarepa. Here's a teaching from Milarepa. So this woman comes to Milarepa and she wants instructions about meditation. And this is written by a woman whose original language is Portuguese, so it's a little hard for me to read it, but her letters are clear if I get it right. Milarepa said to the woman, "Look at the sky without increasing it nor diminishing it. Look at the mountains without moving away or attempting to hold on to them. Look at the sea without getting lost on the surface or in the depths of it. And then look at the mind without altering it in any way." That is what awareness does. It looks in that way. It sees in that way. In the same way that the clouds are not separate from the sky and the waves are not separate from the ocean, experiences are not separate from awareness. Beginning to see that which sees is how we come out of confusion. It's how we get off the Ferris wheel.
It's how seeking softens into unfoldment. And this seeing what sees is ultimately the solution to all problems. It is, in Tibetan Buddhism, the Rigpa, original, pure mind. It is the gate to the Buddha nature. It is the resolution to the fundamental conundrum of the human mind. And it's where our true happiness lies. Space of being is always already awake unto itself. This awareness is already, always awake unto itself. It's not a self-image and it's not a self-idea. It's what sees the self-image or self-idea. It's what sees everything. And it's a no-thing. Or another way to say it, it's nothing. Even space, the word space, and our association to that, our connotation of that, all you can say is awareness is like space. You can't say that awareness is space. Because awareness sees the space, doesn't it? Everything is seen or recognized in this awareness. And every time, every single time this awareness wakes up, is recognized, is seen, conditioning drops. Conditioning drops a little, a lot, and in some cases rare, but it does happen completely. This that I'm pointing at is the basis of life itself for us. It's the original nature, and its flavor is that of contentment. Its vibration is that of peace, and its radiance is that of happiness. And all the teachings, all the great teachers say this in one way or another. And so here's a great poet, teacher, Rumi. He said it like this. I lived on the lip of insanity. That's the Ferris wheel. Wanting to know reasons. Knocking on a door, it opens. I've been knocking from the inside. So this formless, formless, aware presence is the wonderful absence of the familiarity of fixation on content, which seems to generate the friction of unhappiness, that we then seek happiness from. This formless, aware presence is awake unto itself. It doesn't seek. It doesn't avoid. What we're talking about is simply recognizing it. And as it's recognized, it can feel like your allegiance in life is shifting. Whether you liked it or not, your allegiance to life prior to the shift was to maintain the Ferris wheel. And you did it with your mind. And you did it because you couldn't help it. And you did it because you didn't know another way.
And you did it because you didn't hear the true meaning of repentance. You simply, helplessly, innocently, out of conditioning, were looking in the wrong direction. This could be the residential event of bonus prizes. So the bonus prize right now is, as this is recognized, those temporal relative happinesses and unhappinesses, they can still go on. That's fine. It's just that your allegiance to them shifts. Beaches are still beautiful, skies are maybe even more beautiful. People, in all the ways they show up, are even that much more interesting. Food can still taste wonderful, and even more wonderful. Death is not something to fear. And when it doesn't go your way, instead of it being a problem, it's a situation. And it's interesting. It's interesting to see how the mind still wants to react. Instead of, this is wrong, this shouldn't be happening, this is in the way. That's part of the bonus prize. But the real prize, okay, the real prize is the recognition itself of this aware, alert, alive, unseeking awareness. It never goes after happiness. It never goes after anything. It's resting as itself. Can we sit for a minute or two?